Well, for me, the issue was the responsibility of the two so-called progressives, the two who favored rent control, Brown and Crone, to get this issue on the agenda, the rent control just eviction extension, over the holidays, even if they didn't get it voted in, as a way of essentially alerting the community to the need for that, alerting renters that this was being tried and being frustrated by a conservative outgoing majority that no longer had the confidence of the public, that had been in essence, that it, whose terms had lapsed and their conservative replacements had been voted down, though, has to be honestly said, part of that was because there were so many right-wingers running against each other, and on the progressives for once kind of pulled together and only had two candidates. So the issue is who puts items on the agenda, and the answer is the mayor. But obviously, any council member can pressure that by any way she or he can arouse the public to raise the issue with the mayor. I mean, putting an issue on the agenda does not mean it gets voted in. It just means it gets voted on. And to give the public a chance to do that is an important thing to do. And who knows? It might have gotten a majority of votes, at least for a temporary suspension, given the fact that the incoming council was clearly of the opinion that there needed to be a rent control measure of some kind on, and they wanted to talk about it. They wanted to establish a commission to look into it, perhaps. I'm not quite sure what their actual operation is going to be. But that seemed to be pretty much what they were saying during their campaign, Cummins and Glover. And that's what Brown and Crone seemed to want to do, too. So putting it on the agenda was important, and essentially making a point of the mayor's not putting it on the agenda was also important. And I'm particularly sensitive to Sandy Brown's failure to respond to not just requests from some members of the public, myself specifically, full disclosure, but also to keep the promises that she's made. And I've talked about this repeatedly in her failure to forward emails, making specific email requests of staff that they give information, which they may or may not give, but at least it'll be on record that they were requested by a council member to do so. And when she's promised to do these kinds of things publicly and declined to do them, her credibility becomes problematic. And the need to essentially expose this, to me, is something I continue to bring up in broadcast after broadcast, and will continue to do so. But in this case, the particular issue was, did she ask Mayor Terrazas to put an issue on the agenda on November 27th for essentially an extension of the rent freeze and the just eviction law that was going to end on December 11th? And she didn't, according to Terrazas, when I talked to him. And in fact, when she herself admitted that she'd only talked to other council members and the city manager, and since it's the mayor who makes up the agenda, that really wouldn't do. And one could say, well, why not? Why didn't she do it? Doesn't she favor this? And the answer is she probably does. But like most council members who are, quote, liberals, they want to sort of act cautiously and hopefully get a majority of the council with them and round up the votes before they do, and not take isolated positions. Now, this has been less true of Brown and Crone because they are have been for the last 2 years in an isolated minority position on the city council. And in some respects, they have spoken out quite forcefully and quite articulately on important issues. Not as much as I'd like, of course, and they haven't taken the actions that I think are necessary to expose the real power in the city council, the staff, though I think it occasionally gets mentioned. But they spend a lot of time, less time than ass-kissing Micah Posner, who did this endless genuflecting to the staff, or the conservative majority headed by Terrazas and Matthews, who have nothing but praise for the staff. But the staff needs to be held accountable, and so does the city manager. And one of the things I wanted to find out was there's some confusion about how can you get rid of the city manager and the city attorney. And the answer is you need 4 votes, and they have 4 votes. They could get rid of the city manager and the city attorney if they want. That is according to the city charter, which you can find online. It's 801, section 801. The city manager, city clerk, and city attorney shall be appointed by and may be removed by the affirmative votes of at least four members of the council, provided, however, that no such officer may be removed within 60 days prior to or within 90 days following a general municipal election, except by the affirmative votes of at least five members of the council. So for the first 90 days, you need five members. So until March or April, you're going to need, well, let's see, December, January, February, until March, you're going to need five votes. And you probably won't get five votes because you have three holdover conservatives. You have Mayor Watkins, you have Councilmember Chase. So it's Watkins, Matthews, and Myers who are the majority or the minority council members. And one of them would certainly vote to probably retain City Manager Martine Bernal and City Attorney Tony Condotti. One thing I may have erred on in criticizing Tony Condotti was his claim that the Brown Act, the act that requires 72-hour notice before an item gets put on the agenda. It became an important issue for me because the issue of an emergency item, because we were getting so close to the December 11th deadline, it was important to me to put an emergency item on the agenda for December 11th, and that's something that it seemed to me could be done by a majority of the city council, or at least it could be attempted. Now, it actually requires a supermajority. It requires five people, and to put it on the agenda seems to require the mayor or three council members demanding it of the mayor. Or raising it at city council and having it put on the agenda that way. It's a little unclear from the sections that I got from the city administrator, Bonnie Bush. So I criticized Condotti for saying, oh, you can't do it without announcing it 72 hours in advance. And I had thought, no, it's an emergency item. All you need to do is you need to have five votes during a council session, and an emergency finding that there is some kind of an emergency. But the Brown Act, according to the citations that were sent to me by the city administrator, seems to say that you need to establish that something happened after the agenda was put out that requires you to take some new action. An emergency can't be something that was clearly evident before the agenda was set up. So when the agenda was set up, if the so-called emergency had already been known, it could have been put on the agenda. And the fact that they screwed up and didn't put it on the agenda is not a basis for saying at the council, oh, whoops, let's quickly put it on the agenda, because the public has to be informed 72 hours in advance of what is going to be talked about at city council, so they can supposedly, and this is kind of a fantasy, but this is the theory, they can weigh in on what's going on. They can be advised of it. They can provide public testimony. They can know what's happening. Hopefully they can raise the roof, if necessary, to stop the city council from giving away the store to the latest developer standing in line looking for a handout. So according to the Brown Act, there are three circumstances under which items that weren't put on the agenda can then later be put on the agenda closer to the city council meeting or at the city council meeting. And the legislative body, the city council, can act on an item that had not been put on the agenda but then suddenly gets put on. That's when a majority decides there is an emergency situation as defined for emergency meetings. When two-thirds of the members present, or all members, if less than two-thirds are present, determine there is a need for immediate action and the need to take action came to the attention of the local agency subsequent to the agenda being posted, which is what I said a moment ago. It has to have happened after the agenda got posted. You can't say, oh, it was an emergency beforehand, we forgot about it. No, can't do that. This exception requires a degree of urgency. An item cannot be considered under this provision if the staff knew about the need to take immediate action before the agenda was posted. A new need does not arise because the staff forgot or an applicant missed a deadline. And then there's a third condition that if you had another meeting less than 5 days earlier, you can continue talking about that item without having it on the agenda because it was continued from the last meeting. So what is an emergency situation? Well, first of all, apparently it needs a majority to decide that. And they had a majority, after the city council, new city council members were seated in the evening of December 11th. Drew Glover and Justin Cummins were seated, and they joined Sandy Brown and Chris Crone. So they could have suggested that there was an emergency situation that required an immediate rent freeze be put on the agenda and voted on, at least for the next month, until such time as they could consider it regularly at the next city council meeting. They did not. Now, they might have, the city attorney might have insisted, oh, hold it, you can't do this because it's not really an emergency. You knew this was coming up. You know, you have no new information in the last 4 or 5 days after the agenda was posted. He should have gone to Mayor Terrazas and said, oh, please, Mayor Terrazas, put this on the agenda. And indeed, I have no indication that any council member did go to Terrazas and request to be put on the agenda. Maybe they felt it would have been futile. Maybe they felt they were, you know, going to just bide their time after they're, after all, they're not going to get evicted. Although I think that's not necessarily true of Drew Glover, who did state over the air that he was in under threat of eviction himself over the holidays. So, you know, he does have a real concern. But apparently they didn't think enough to advise Glover, his council colleagues, his progressive buddies running with him or supporting him, to let him know that he had the option to bring this issue up at the city council meeting where they were all kind of going hurrah and huzzah and then retired across the street to the Civic Auditorium to have drinks and cakes and coffee and so forth, while the tenants get to tremble in fear over the vacation, over the threat of landlord eviction. So I don't know. I began this by saying I want to make an apology, but I don't think I want to. I'm not really sure I do want to apologize. I kind of going back and forth because it seems as I read over this kind of somewhat not entirely clear language to me, that, again, these council members could have proposed an emergency situation. They might have been defeated. They might have been batted down by the city attorney, but they didn't even try. And that, to me, is really the telling thing. And they could have held a special session. They could have gone to hold a special session. I suggested that, too. I'm not aware that there was any attempt to do that either, though I understand from Glover that Cummins was leaving town, which would have left them short of their majority. But still, the issue, again, letting other tenants know, letting the activists who work so hard to put Measure M on the ballot, that they are still in there pitching and fighting, and letting the landlords know that there will be a cost to evictions over the winter holidays if they're going to try and evict people. A really important thing to do, and it wasn't done. And I'm going to leave it there for the moment, though I probably have more to say on this issue. It's so technical and so kind of arcane and, you know, bureaucratic that I don't know that it interests the majority of the people listening. But I said what I've said. Let's take a musical break. This is Arlo Guthrie and Family's tribute to Mary Travers, who I think died about 5 years ago, of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Sometimes as I think about some of the friends that were there when I was a kid growing up, I was always a little younger than, and now, of course, that's all changed.
Arlo Guthrie.
You know, I was about the age of Chris or something when I first started playing, and in public, and I remember I was going to college briefly. I wanted to be a forest ranger. That was my... I didn't like being around large crowds of people, and I thought, forest ranger, that sounds good. Sit on a mountain, wait for a fire or something every few years, get home, just take out the guitar, banjo, play with some friends or something. I thought that was what it was going to be. So my life is a karmic disaster. But there were some good people that I got to meet along the way. And those that were not just popular, but those that stood up, you know, for the right stuff was out in the streets. And I'm thinking about Mary Travers, who just passed away a little while back, you know, of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And they're doing a... There's a whole lot I could say, but the truth is that anybody who was there at the time knows how important it was for people for people who were popular and successful, not just guys like me that was, you know, sort of crawling around the streets of the village or something, but those people were taking risks at a time when Pete Seeger, for example, was not allowed on TV or stuff like that. So to be out there on the streets talking about things that was going on was great, and they were there, and she was there. And they, at one point, I remember, were supporting Cesar Chavez with the grape strike, supporting the United Farm Workers, you know. And I remember thinking about how funny that was, that all you had to do was to not buy something, and everything would change for these guys. And sure enough, nobody bought grapes for, I don't know, a few months, whatever it was, but everything changed. And so one of the things that's going to happen at this little memorial coming up in about 2 weeks from now, maybe less, is that those of us who can't be there will be sending in some little songs on video that, about the times that they went through. And the one that they've asked us to do was this song here that my dad wrote back years ago. So we're going to record this right now, and we will be a part of the memorial and the celebration of Mary Travers' life that will happen.
Just, his dad was, of course, from now. Woody Guthrie.
And although at the moment, it's happening right now, too. I love how that happens. It goes to show you that the people that you love and sing about are... the time is the illusion of things. It's not the real thing. Here we are. Here in Homer, and at the same time, we're in New York City. And I love it. Singing a song about some folks that died years ago that my dad found a newspaper article about and wrote in a little couple of verses. And a college student named Martin Hoffman, years later, put a little tune to it. And it became one of the most popular of my dad's songs. And it goes something like this. It could have been wrote last week. Crops are all in, the peaches are rotty, the oranges are piled in their creosote dumps. They're flying you back to the Mexican border to pay all your money to wade back again. My father's old father, he waded that river. They took all the money that he made. My brothers and sisters come working the fruit trees. They rode the trucks till they took down and died. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be. Some of us are illegal, and others not wanted. Our work contract's out, and we have to move on. But it's 600 miles to the Mexican border. They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers and thieves. We've died in your hills, and we've died in your deserts. We've died in your valleys. We've died in your trees, and we've died beneath your bushes. Both sides of the river, we've died just the same. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all that will call you. Who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves? The radio says they are just deportees. Is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? And is this the best way we can grow our...
dry leaves and right on the topsoil and be known by no name except D14s. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita, adios mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they'll call you will be D14s.
And that was actually published way back in 2009, and it's available on YouTube. And it's called Arlo Guthrie and Family Pay Tribute to Mary Travers. So to return for a moment to the rent control, just eviction protection, city council diddle-dee-doo that has gone on throughout November and December, evading the issue, avoiding the issue, letting the city attorney, Anthony Condotti, kind of define the terms of the issue. Back in the last meeting in November, Condotti made the claim that there could not be an emergency item on the agenda. I think it was the 27th of November. It might have been one of the subsequent meetings, but he did make the claim at one of those meetings in the last few meetings of this last council, that you couldn't actually put something on the agenda as an emergency item at the actual meeting itself unless you could make an emergency finding, which I read for you that information from the Brown Act a few minutes ago, unless you could show that there was some urgency situation that had come up, and then you had to get a 5 majority to pass it. But at the December 4th meeting, Anthony Condotti himself apparently got the city attorney, or I should say the city mayor, to put on the agenda this special idea that at a closed session at the California, one of the landlords association had said, if you pass this other bill, which essentially requires landlords to give a 90-day kind of a notice to people before they evict them, or else they have to, and if you evict them improperly during that period, you need to pay them relocation expenses, that could not be put on the agenda, according to the California Tenants Association, because it was preempted by state law. And the point was that this item was not on the agenda. The discussion of this item was not on the agenda. But the California Landlord Association, and I guess it's the California Apartment Association, I'm not quite getting their name right, but it was a Sacramento group that pointed out an old court decision that apparently Condotti had overlooked when this measure had passed a first reading it passed a sort of an initial reading. It required a second reading, or it required actually a new reading because it was being changed around. But it was essentially kind of coming down the pike. But at this special session, it wasn't supposed to be on the agenda for discussion at all. It was going to come up a few weeks later and have a vote then. But Condotti, the guy who claims you can't put something on the agenda unless it really is, there's an urgency measure an emergency situation that comes up after the agenda has been made, put it on the agenda anyway. What he put on the agenda was the attempt essentially to kill the measure based upon a threat he got from this landlord association that they would sue in court against it, claiming that the state law prohibits them from passing as a local community any extension of this period of time that requires landlords to give notice to people who they are evicting. And so he seemed to one of our listeners who brought this up to me later after hearing my show or hearing me talk at city council, that the city attorney himself was contradicting his own advice. And I'm still kind of chewing this over, but I thought I'd put it out on the air because it shows you really have to... It could well be he was doing that. He was, in essence, saying he was allowing this landlord association to raise an issue that he thought was urgent enough because it might cost them money if there were a lawsuit to essentially frighten the city council into blocking the whole measure. and stopping a second reading of it, which was coming up in 2 weeks. Which to me tends to show that people in high positions make their own choices. This is nothing personal with respect to Tony Condotti. He's a nice enough guy. I say this often about people whose actions I criticize, but it's also true for him. I haven't seen much of him since he became city attorney. He used to be sort of the second in command or third in command or one of the team of the John Barisoni city attorney gang that ran the city attorney's office years ago when a lot of us were fighting battles to stop the city from harassing homeless people with endless criminal prosecutions for sleeping, which was sort of the sleeping ban central was the city attorney's office. They were doing a lot of that. And we were doing a lot of fighting against it. And Tony Condotti was kind of an amiable fellow who was, you know, he was a second in command or a third in command. I'm not quite sure where he was in the pecking order, but he became city attorney afterward when Barisoni retired. But here he is getting the city council to put on the agenda, and in closed session, no less, a whole discussion of an item that, without it going through a regular process of agendizing, using essentially short-circuiting and skipping over his own claim, which he had made previously, that you could not put an item on the agenda without a real urgency finding and a vote of the city council. And so I've kind of put together a letter to send to the city council asking for any record of any urgency finding that justified Tony Condotti's, or the city council for that matter, even discussing this item at the city council level and then voting on it when it had no urgency finding on this issue. Because he claimed that was necessary. And the Brown Act does indeed say it's necessary. So just sort of mentioning that, we'll see if we hear anything from them. Often we don't. Here's a story from the San Francisco Chronicle of December 22nd. Judge reverses eviction of student. And I found this story sort of horrific enough for me to want to pass it on. You can find it in the Saturday Sentinel, yesterday's Sentinel. The Oakland Housing Authority said Friday it would comply with the judge's order to allow a college student back into her apartment after she was kicked out 2 weeks ago, her attorney said. An Alameda County Superior Court judge on Thursday ordered Oakland public housing officials to immediately allow a tenant back into her apartment. As of late Thursday, Bonnie Rout had remained locked out of the West Oakland unit. It was her 15th day homeless after an improper eviction, according to her lawyers. On Friday, Rout was allowed to get her possessions, and the housing authority said it would pay for a hotel room for her. Rout was $125 behind on rent when the Oakland Housing Authority impounded her two dogs, placed her possessions into locked storage, and changed her apartment door locks, said one of her pro bono attorneys, Emma Dinkelspiel of the Bay Area Legal Aid. Rout had lived in the one-bedroom apartment in Campbell Village for 5 years. The items that Rout, a 24-year-old student at Merritt College, had been unable to access included her homework and a textbook on administrative justice that she needed to return to her school. She was also unable to receive medical equipment that she had been shipped to her apartment for knee surgery recovery. For the past 2 weeks, while she was taking final exams, Rout had been sleeping in a car that belongs to her mother, who is also homeless. On Thursday, hoping to get the court order enforced, Rout and her attorney said they went to the Alameda County Sheriff's Office, whose deputies directed them to the Oakland Police Department. Oakland police officers told them to speak with the Oakland Housing Authority Police Department, which directed them to the property management company that oversees Campbell Village. Finally, a company representing